You're listening to the Illusion of More podcast. I'm David Newhoff. Author and technology observer Andrew Keen has written his third book about the digital age, and its unequivocal title is The Internet is Not the Answer. Keen became an internet entrepreneur in 1995 with the founding of AudioCafe.com, and he is currently the executive director of Silicon Valley Salon Futurecast, a senior fellow at Cal Innovates, and he is the host of the technology talk show Keen On, as well as a columnist for CNN. I had a chance to read Andrew's new book before the end of last year, and I do recommend it to readers looking for a solid, broad analysis as to why the internet hasn't yet lived up to its promises, but still could. Andrew was kind enough to grant me an interview, and I spoke to him in San Francisco via Skype. So, talking about the internet is not the answer, the title of your new book, which has just come out. And I'd like to ask a broad question right off the bat. And that is, the internet is not the answer to what question? What is it you think that society is looking for or expecting that it is we need, to which, you know, that the internet is not fulfilling?
I don't think the internet is the answer, at the moment at least, to the question of what the, and I'm using this term slightly irreverently, but I don't think the internet is the answer as the operating system for our digitally networked 21st century. At the moment, it's not working very well. It's creating things that are actually the opposite of what we hoped it would. So it's not a, at least as a standalone system, it's not, I think, a very good operating system.
And for people who haven't sort of tracked the history, and of course you come from something of an insider's point of view. You've been in Silicon Valley for some time, and you've been an internet entrepreneur in your life. And but for those who have not paid as much attention to sort of how this has evolved, how would you summarize the vision that was and how it changed to where we ended up where we are, I should say, as of right now?
Well, thank you for that question. The first almost 100 pages of the book actually is a short history, both of the internet, at least at first, and then of the World Wide Web. The potted history is that it was founded, I think, by idealists, usually either academics or government officials, who wanted, in the language of one man, J.C.R. Licklider, who was one of the most distinguished and eccentric of these founders, a human-computer symbiosis that would improve the world, would create, if you like, more democracy, more opportunities. And this ideal was, I think, developed through the invention of the World Wide Web by Tim Berners-Lee, and originally in 1989. And then it began to change in about 1992, 1993. The first sort of symbolic moment in this transformation was the Netscape IPO. And after that, I think the internet has been hijacked by entrepreneurs, investors, who, not necessarily knowingly or consciously, I think, have mostly corrupted the original ideals of the founder. It's not that different from so many other revolutionary movements that were begun by idealists, people who really wanted to make the world a better place, and then was eventually the ideal was corrupted by people who implemented it.
As a result, what is your response? I know what mine often is, but what is your response when you sort of meet people with this notion of keep the internet for the people, keep the internet free? My instinctive take is well, that would be nice, except that it isn't.
Well, my response would be, of course, as an author, read my book. Not just because I want them especially with these people, to buy the book.
Right.
But because they could even steal it, necessarily. I'd rather they read the book. I'd rather they pay for it, but I want them to read it. But I think the history of the internet is really important to understand, that the internet, there's this kind of mythology that the internet was delivered by a stork in the middle of the night by some well-meaning startup in Silicon Valley, and that of course isn't true. It came out of the public interest. It came out mostly of government investment, government-sponsored technology. Some of it came out of the Cold War. Some of it was a consequence of other sort of military industrial policy. And so the idea that it was created for the people, by the people, I think, is a delusion. And I think one of the most troubling aspects of public policy today is the way in which some of the more profitable private companies, like Google in particular, and Facebook and some of the others, have appropriated the idea of the public internet for their own interests and are actually using it to become more and more profitable and monopolistic. So, like you, I'm very troubled by that. I think it's a major issue, and I think everyone needs to understand the way in which public opinion has been so cleverly co-opted by some of these large internet companies.
Yeah, I agree, and I could sort of answer the question for myself, I suppose, but I often wonder, you know, why people continue to believe, believe in that egalitarian notion, that democratic idea, despite so much mounting evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's face it. In some ways, the internet is amazing. In some ways, it does give everybody a voice. Now you can go on Twitter and in 10 seconds open an account and broadcast to the world.
Right.
Now you can be on Facebook. Now you can get this amazing technology that allows you to connect with people all over the world. And as I say at the beginning of the book, I don't think this is a bad thing. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not against technology. I'm as wired as anyone. In fact, DQ magazine just announced that I was one of their top 100 networked people in the world. So, you know, I'm not against any of this stuff.
Right.
But what I point out in the book is the ironic consequence of all this supposedly democratic technology of the supposedly flat world is actually even more exaggerated inequality of wealth and opportunity and of artistic license.
And that's exactly where I was going to go next, is, you know, jump to the meat of the matter, as I see it anyway, is what's happening economically. I don't think it's terribly controversial to say things like, you know, we're hollowing out the middle class, that the ultra wealthy are becoming even more wealthy, more powerful every day. But when we look and point to the internet as either causing or exacerbating that particular problem, that's when I think critics start to say, well, why are you blaming the internet? Why are you blaming the digital age? And I think you make several good points about that in the book, but I'd like to ask you, you know, how is it, what do you think are the mechanics that by which the internet as we've created it now are exacerbating that exact problem, the wealth consolidation?
I think the first point to make, and you really made it actually on my behalf, is that the internet is exacerbating these problems. I don't think the internet is causing inequality. It's not the first mover. You know, even if the internet hadn't been invented, even if Tim Berners-Lee had been knocked over by a truck in 1988 in Switzerland, and had never invented the web, you would still have these structural inequalities, and this massive wealth gap, and all the other things that are so troubling many of us. But certainly the internet is exaggerating these things. I think it's important to make the point that the internet is, for better or worse, the operating system of the 21st century. Every industry now is being reinvented, not just media. Media went through it in the 90s. And in the beginning of the 21st century, but now it's medicine, now it's transportation, now it's education, now it's banking, now it's government. And as all these industries begin to be dramatically transformed, the winner-take-all nature of the digital economy, which enables or empowers the appearance of these monstrously large companies, whether it's Amazon or Google or Facebook, is actually mirroring much of what's gone wrong. And just as the internet was supposed to be this place which enabled anyone to build a business, anyone to have a voice, what we're seeing in the 21st century is not only the appearance of multi-billionaires like Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos or Sergey Brin or Larry Page, all of whom, by the way, are worth about $30 billion. Collectively, they could buy most countries, those four guys. But also radically unequal cultural economies where a tiny proportion of celebrities are controlling networks like Twitter or Facebook. And I think this reflects the work of Anita Ellsberg from Harvard Business School, mm-hmm. who wrote a very important book called Blockbusters, which reflects this. The reality and the old entertainment economy, I know you're particularly interested in that area, the old entertainment economy certainly wasn't ideal, it wasn't ideally democratic, it had a lot of problems, but I think it was better. I think there was more opportunity for people to succeed. Mm. There was more of a structure whereby someone with talent could be rewarded. In today's world, unless you're a 15-year-old girl with, you know, 5 million followers on YouTube because of the confessional two-minute slot you have on YouTube, people of talent aren't being rewarded in this new world.
Right, and that is the irony, isn't it? That and not just, of course, with entertainment, that we do have, not to tout my own title, but this illusion that anybody can play, and it's true. Like you say, anybody can jump out there, but the mechanisms for turning that into something, into an entrepreneurial opportunity, into a business, are actually dwindling, or they're actually shrinking.
Yeah, it's a tragic irony. We're creating a lottery-style world where one person, Mark Zuckerberg, may win big, and he probably deserves it. He's a really smart guy, worked very hard, it's a very good idea. Mm. But for the vast majority of us, there's absolutely no chance, both in terms of business and in terms of the cultural economy. And the savage irony is that what's being destroyed is the middle. So that world of the middle class, of the middle sector, of the midlist in the cultural economy has been decimated. You're always going to have a high end. You're always going to have an elite. And then you've got everything else. And the middle world that was essential, I think, for creativity and economic justice is being blown away. And that reflects these broader economic and cultural forces. It's not just the internet. It's not just the digital network. But it is playing a more and more pronounced role in the destruction of the middle and the destruction of a world where everyone had a chance to succeed.
And to be specific, you cite in the book, for example, Uber and Airbnb, which I think are great subjects in the sense that, you know, they're new, they're hot. People are talking about them, both good and bad. They certainly appear on the surface as opportunities for regular folks to make either a living or a supplement a living out of resources that they maybe already have. And yet, there's an extent to which they are job killers. So let me ask you. I mean, what is the downside of businesses like Uber and Airbnb? Why do you talk about them in the book?
Well, just as a caveat. I mean, there are some upsides. I mean,
yep.
A lot of people now, I think, in particular, using Airbnb enables some people to travel where they wouldn't have been able to afford hotels.
Yep.
Whilst Uber has got awful press, mostly justifiably, and I go after Uber in the book, I mean, not everything about Uber is bad.
Right.
That said, though, I would say there's two or three downsides. The first, that these are monopoly plays. The reason why Uber now, and just think, Uber is valued at $40 billion. This is a company that's in regulatory trouble, has terrible public relations image, But the reason why so much money is pouring into Uber, they just raised, I think, a new round of $1 billion in a private investment. This is the largest private company, the privately held startup in the whole history of capitalism. The reason is because people see Uber as the new monopoly, as the new platform play. Thousands of independent cab companies are being swept away everywhere I go in America and around the world. Cab drivers want to talk about Uber, particularly small cab owners. I was in Detroit. The guy has six cabs. He's a small business owner. And he understands that with Uber, he loses his power. Anyone can become an Uber driver.
Mm-hmm.
But that small entrepreneur and the cab industry was dominated by, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of small entrepreneurs get swept away, which accounts for Uber's absurd, obscene valuation. Let's be frank. The cab industry is not ideal. We've all sat in the back of cabs, which is disgusting. There's rude drivers who have tried to rip us off. So there's certainly, a self-evident need for the traditional cab industry to improve itself, just as the music industry needed to improve itself. None of these industries are perfect, far from it. The cab industry is, I think, about as imperfect as most traditional industries. But that said, the other problem with Uber is its lack of respect both for its customers and for its employees. There are more and more cases, and I cite some of them in my book, of the way in which Uber rips off its drivers. Its drivers now are striking, even if Uber won't allow them to be members of the union. The way in which it's become this kind of parody of free market libertarianism. Travis Kalanick, the co-founder, CEO, is a hardcore follower of Ayn Rand, you know, the hardcore libertarian, is that, you know, when it rains heavily, suddenly the prices go up 30, 40, 50, 100, 500%. So we're all being ripped off one way or the other by Uber. Most troublingly, I think, is their complete disdain for regulation. Airbnb, I think, is a much less problematic company than Uber. Mm-hmm. Certainly its management is less ethically challenged. But even Airbnb comes with a serious moral caveat. Most of the people, it seems, who are renting their rooms out on or their homes out on Uber, on Airbnb, are not paying taxes. So it's this idea that somehow now we can all rent out our homes, and which we're doing, but we're not paying taxes. We don't understand that the way in which a civilized society works is for us to pay taxes, is being swept away by this so-called sharing economy. So the real problem here isn't necessarily peer-to-peer businesses. The real problem is the way in which some of these pioneering peer-to-peer businesses are really actually kind of indifferent to broader social issues, broader social issues about workers' rights, taxes. It's a very similar sort of issue that we saw at the beginning of the industrial age.
Yeah.
And once again, we're faced with these profound problems. If we're going to civilize this revolution, we need to recognize its fatal flaws. And I think the fatal flaw of the peer-to-peer revolution is this hostility to government, as if there shouldn't be a role for government. And there has to be. Who really wants to stay in an Airbnb home that isn't properly insured? Who wants to drive in an Uber cab where the driver hasn't been checked out? When I was in Detroit a few months ago, the owner of this small cab company told me that his brother-in-law just came out of jail. He served 10 years for manslaughter. He's not allowed to drive a traditional cab, but of course he got a job driving for Uber because they don't check the background of the drivers. We've had a tragic example of this in India, where one of the drivers raped a woman passenger because his record wasn't checked.
Right. Yeah, it is, you mentioned the early Industrial Revolution or the 20th century American Industrial Revolution, and it does often feel that we have to relearn some of the same lessons, doesn't it? In the sense that, you know, regulation has become a very bad word, even on both ends of the political spectrum for different reasons. And yet we forget that some of the regulations that were put in place actually benefit everybody. If you mentioned the, you know, Uber price gouging when it rains, you know, worker conditions, these basic things that,
yeah,
that
were... Kids, 12-year-olds working in factories, mm. environmental conditions. I think one of the best sort of comparisons or perhaps metaphors of what's going on is to compare it to the Industrial Revolution in terms of the environmental movement.
Mm-hmm.
So I think data exploitation, for example, is the... you know, the equivalent of pollution in the digital age. And I do think we need to learn. I think one of my cultural critiques of digital world is the way in which it's destroyed the past and the future, where everything is lived in the present. We're living in a kind of tyranny of the present.
Interesting.
And as such, we've lost our collective memory. It's weird, the internet hasn't learned how to forget, which is its problem in terms of its tyranny of data and the NSA and the panopticon-like nature of the world in which we're increasingly living, where everyone's watching everything we're doing, or we're all watching the sort of the narcissism of what each of us are doing. But the internet doesn't know how to forget, and we're forgetting how to learn how to remember. Mm. We're losing our historical abilities. So there's these two issues of memory and forgetting are, I think, central. I think that's one of the most profound and depressing cultural consequences of all this. And it may have to do, again, with free culture and our indifference increasingly to learning and listening for people who spend their lives thinking about these issues.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, I've in a couple of posts and also just among friends and colleagues, I find myself saying, you know, it's a little bit like living in the time of Vanderbilt, but there's no guarantee that at the end we'll even get a railroad. That, you know, it feels like...
Well, we do have a railroad. I think the thing is that Vanderbilt built the railroads,
right?
Whereas Google or Facebook or Amazon didn't build the network.
Right.
So there's a kind of a weird difference.
Mm-hmm.
They don't acknowledge the role of the government in all this. And the government, you know, the government did and didn't build the railroads, but of course it required private investment. And that doesn't mean that some of these companies aren't capable of a lot of good.
Right.
And some of the entrepreneurs, I think, are capable of a lot of good. I think someone like Mark Benioff at Salesforce.com is an example of someone who is committed to the public good. And even people like Zuckerberg, who I'm not a great fan of, have nonetheless given away some portion of their immense wealth for public mm-hmm. interest issues like education. The problem, I think, is that in Silicon Valley in particular, there's this kind of moral cocoon, a kind of echo chamber, mm. and no one is really critical. So no one's really telling the truth. Hopefully my book will be, to some extent, a wake-up call for what's really happening.
Yes, you do You do spend some time, I was just going to say, sort of talking again. You've been an insider. You've met a lot of these people. You do spend some time trying to, you know, give us a sense of their personalities, of some of the individuals who effectively are running the internet as we know it today. And, you know, do you find yourself being criticized for painting them unfairly? Or do you think, you know, do people sort of respond and say, yep, no, this is sort of the spirit of the Valley as we understand?
Yeah, I think that things are changing quite dramatically. As I'm sure you know, I wrote a book in 2007 called Cult of the Amateur,
mm-hmm.
which was the first book that really aggressively, perhaps a little too aggressively, challenged many of the principles of the Web 2.0 revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And the book did well. I'm not necessarily complaining because I'm a polemicist, so as a polemicist, one wants to be vilified. That's how you sell books and get speeches. But I was universally vilified. Everyone said I was a reactionary and elitist, someone who was in the pay of big media, someone who didn't understand this new world, and the rest of it. But over the last 7 or 8 years, since 2007, I think there's been a substantial cultural shift. You've had more and more people also writing important books, Nick Carr, Jerome Lanier, Sherry Turkle. Mm-hmm. More and more people actually questioning what's really happening. Many, like myself, who were either initial believers or insiders. Jerome Lanier, of course, famously invented virtual reality, very brilliant technologist. And I think the public perception has changed. And I also think that there are more and more moderate voices within, or responsible adult voices within tech, who get the problem. So, for example, in the book, I'm not quoting reactionaries. I'm not quoting outsiders. I'm quoting insiders. I quote Fred Wilson, for example, yeah, one of New York's most important investors from Union Square Ventures, on the monopoly, the dangers of monopoly. I quote Emily Bell, who was the original architect of The Guardian Online, about the way in which the internet journalism is dominated by a tiny group of men. I quote Jeff Jarvis, who's a very outspoken believer in the internet, one might even call him a utopian, about the way in which increasingly discourse has been corrupted by what he calls assholes. So I quote Clay Shirky, another guy who gets criticized, but I actually think he's really smart and a very moral, decent person, about the tragedy of journalists losing their jobs. So I think more and more people are actually recognizing that there's a serious problem here. And people like Robert Scoble, who used to be very critical of my work, said to me several times recently, he said, I kind of agree with a lot of what you're saying.
Yes, no, I agree. I think even in the compared to you very short time that I've been paying attention to these issues, I think even in the last 2-3 years, I think the amount of reporting that is citing the problem, if you will, from one point of view or another, is gone up dramatically. And you know, and on that note, you know, I want to talk about something else you bring up in the book, which getting, obviously, as you mentioned, that, you know, economics is the heart of it. But you also talk quite a bit about what I'll summarize as the voluntary surveillance state that we have created for ourselves. One that, as you say, would make a Soviet era East German jealous. And I wanted to ask you to summarize that for folks who have not yet had the pleasure of reading the book.
And again, to sort of quote one of the early believers in the internet, Berkman Center's Ethan Zuckerman, he says that the free model, the so-called free economy, and of course that's a contradiction in terms of the internet, was the original sin of the internet. Mm. That original sin being, of course, the idea that companies like Google and Facebook would give their products for free and sell advertising around them. But of course, what this has created is us as the product. It's created a world in which these multi-billion dollar internet companies are perpetually snooping on us, selling us, packaging us up and selling us to advertisers. A world where, say, for example, with Uber now, as it's been revealed in the scandals over Uber in late 2014, Uber is actually using its data to know where we're going all the time. Now, they're doing it for political reasons, but for Facebook and Google, it's economic reasons. But I mean, this is a fatally flawed world in which most of us are very uncomfortable with the creepiness of this economy. And I think we need to figure out a way, once again, to learn to pay for products. I mean, part of my solution is just paying for search, mm-hmm. paying for technology, paying to be to have access to interesting social network technology. Because these technologies are great. I use Google all the time, but I don't have a Google account. I'll never sign into Google, not because I have any great secrets. It's almost symbolic from my point of view. But most of us are really creeped out with the idea that the only way in which Google can profit from us is by knowing us more and more. And they're very open about this. Eric Schmidt famously says that the goal of Google is to know us better than ourselves. And Google's latest strategy of buying up artificial intelligence companies, Google Glass, their self-driving car, all these are data products. They're not doing it to benefit mankind, although the self-driving car, I think, in itself is a good thing. They're doing it because they want our data. These are companies greedy for our data. Their whole economic modus vivendi is the acquisition of our data.
And there is an extent, you reference Google buying up all these subsidiary companies, the robotics and the you know, things like home thermostats. And I mean, it there are times I think that it reads so much like the first act of a sci-fi movie that I often wonder if that's not part of the reason people don't take it seriously. You know, because it almost feels so much like a work of fiction at times.
Yeah, well, we're living in a peculiar age. Bruce Sterling, the science fiction writer, I think, has said that, and other science fiction writers have said the same thing. It's very hard to write science fiction. You can't do it. So interestingly enough, Sterling has become actually a rather good historian.
That's interesting.
Yeah, we're living, in a sense, in the future, or the idea of the future. But of course, rather than an ideal, it's much more like that dystopia, the warning that many science fiction writers warned us about. You know, Dave Edgar's turned that into a brilliant novel, The Circle. So I think people are beginning to understand that something has gone seriously wrong. It's not hard to see it in the addiction of one's kids to these devices, to their ubiquity, to the way in which we're all creeped out by the latest NSA scandal and the close connection between the NSA and some of these large internet companies or tech companies. I think people are beginning to wake up to this, and I hope that my book will be a wake-up call, a reminder that that this technological revolution is, at the moment at least, deeply flawed.
I hope so too. And on that note, the book is not all bad news. And in particular, you do come to a conclusion, offering some suggested answers. You even cite Teddy Roosevelt and sort of recall the notion of trust busting, which sounds like it's, in your opinion, a part of the answer. In other words, you actually cite a number of politicians around the world who you seem to feel need to stand up to some of these companies, that some of them are getting either too big or too invasive. I don't want to put the wrong word in your mouth, but I'll stop and ask you to sort of summarize that, your answer.
Well, my answer is that government has to be a part of the answer. Sometimes Jeff Jarvis, for example, accuses me of being a European socialist because I believe that the government is an answer. I don't think, certainly I'm not European, I'm English, it's a big difference. I'm not really a socialist, I believe in the market. But right. I think we need to reintroduce the role of government here. And government itself is problematic, of course. Government is slow, it's inefficient, it's bureaucratic. Government is far from ideal. But I think if we don't use government, then what else do we have?
Right.
As these companies become larger and larger, more and more powerful, whether it's Apple or Google, how else can we control them? It's certainly not going to be controlled by the crowd or by some peer-to-peer service. So there needs to be a role for government, but there needs to be a role for the companies themselves. I cite some examples of the way in which entertainment companies and ISPs and Google and Microsoft and the police and credit card companies have all worked together to fight piracy. So it's not just government. I think that there is a need for companies and organizations to work together. But there is a need for law. Just as there was at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, so is the same at the beginning of the digital revolution. These changes are so profound, they shift everything about us. And I think there's a need for a cultural change within Silicon Valley. As I said, we do have positive role models, someone like Mark Benioff. But many of these kids, especially, you know, Travis Kalanick at a ethically challenged company like Uber, need to grow up. Some of the narrative of the book takes place at a private members club called The Battery in downtown San Francisco that epitomizes, reflects this new gilded age. And until these very intelligent, very dynamic entrepreneurs begin to grow up and recognize that they're no longer isolated from the rest of the world, they're in the middle of the world and reshaping everything, then things won't change. I like one of my chapters takes place in Rochester, and I talk about the way in which the Kodak moment is replaced by the Instagram moment.
Yes.
The founder of Kodak used to open up his home to the local community in Rochester so that they could come on a Sunday afternoon to listen to classical music. Mark Zuckerberg, in contrast, has bought up all the homes around him in Palo Alto, three homes, to guarantee his privacy. So I think there are ways in which these new Gilded Age tycoons can learn from the Industrial Age tycoons.
Zuckerberg is perhaps unique in this, although maybe he's not. It is. I'm constantly struck by this notion of the guy who at least presumes to connect everyone. Himself doesn't appear to be want to be connected to anyone.
And I think that Zuckerberg is an example also, and I talk about this in the book, of using the idea of the public interest for his own personal benefit.
Yes.
So Zuckerberg and Sandberg at Facebook, they talk about this idea of connecting up the world, of wiring the world. There, in late 2014, last year, there was a Time magazine cover with him on saying that we need to connect up the 50% of humanity who aren't on the network. And that may be true, and some of the network effect is good for poor societies. But let's be frank, the Zuckerberg and Sandberg's interest in this is not altruistic. They're not doing it for the benefit of mankind. They're doing it because the Facebook business model depends on everyone on the world being on their network.
Right.
So what really troubles me is the way in which so often in Silicon Valley, the public interest is appropriated for private gain. I don't think these people are any worse or better than the railroad barons or industrial chemical barons or oil barons. But where they are in some ways even more troubling is their ability to distort reality and present the ideal of them improving the world when all they're doing is really transforming themselves into multi-billionaires.
Well, and to that point, would you agree that one of the sort of insidious manifestations of this, going back to your point about there a role for government, because what else is there? And I agree, because of course government is what the people have to use, and yet social media so often plays a role, or at least presumes to play a role, as somehow an antidote to government. And it seems to me that that's one of the big tricks in terms of trying to use, you know, regulatory forces, for example, that those who own the Facebooks and the Twitters of the world can so easily play that card of don't let them regulate your internet.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, the idea of peer-to-peer government, or the wise crowd, or whatever you want to call it, doesn't work. And what, as I point out in the book very clearly in a number of different sections, what the internet is doing culturally is creating an echo chamber effect.
Yeah.
It hasn't created this global community. It's actually created, McLuhan warned us about it, it's created what he called the global village, where our village mentality of intolerance is much more pronounced than any sort of global vision of harmony or understanding across cultures. So the kind of people we connect to on Twitter or Facebook, these are people we already know, who share our values, who share our politics. And what we're seeing is the replacement, I think, when it, say, using the example of newspapers. Newspapers used to be, even if it was a left-wing or a right-wing newspaper, it used to be placed, especially on the editorial page, where people of different opinions, conservatives, liberals, leftists, rightists, could discuss, could debate. You don't have any of that on the internet. I don't know of any place on the internet where you have a serious coming together of different political opinions who respectfully talk to one another. And I can't, again, blame the internet for this. You just got to switch on your television and watch Fox or MSNBC to see how this is corrupting our broader culture, too. But the internet is playing an important role. And I think more and more kids who are reliant on Facebook or Twitter to get their news, all they're doing is getting to hear what they already know and what they already think is true. So it's creating a darker and darker, more and more bigoted, narrower and narrower world. It's nothing like the sort of the enlightened vision that, that was supposed to have come out of this revolution.
Yes, I could not agree more. And in fact, and I agree also that it's...
You got to disagree a little bit. You might be, but on
that particular point, I mean, you know, that... That is one of what you just said is one of the major reasons I began writing the blog in the first place. And you know, this what my friend calls epistemic closure, that the internet is a wonderful, at least the internet as has been, as it has evolved to date, is a wonderful way to solidify the biases you already had. The idea that it kind of would...
Yeah, I tell you what I find is that I use Twitter as a broadcast medium. To tell the world what I'm thinking and to promote my ideas and my work and my books. So I don't really follow anyone, partially because it's just I don't have the time, I'm very busy.
Sure.
But partially because I find it depressing. So when I was following people, and then I would sort of take a break from Twitter and then a month or two later go back, and they're all saying, talking to the same people about the same issues. Nothing's changing. So it's a very depressing cultural atmosphere.
Right.
It's depressing and repressive. There's nothing open about it. Again, you know, the internet people talk about this new openness. What I see is a closed world. What I see is not shared understanding, but actually a kind of an increasing intolerance, which you can find more broadly too. But the Puritans are taking over, the pointy nose types who are endlessly persecuting people because they don't agree with them.
And on that happy note, I think we'll wrap this up. I want to thank Andrew Keen for being on the Illusion of More podcast, and thank you for listening.